Well, hello, friends. Greg Kokel here. My job for the next hour is to give you a piece of my mind, and I have a whole bunch of you on board that are going to give me a piece of your minds as well, and I look forward to talking to you here on Stand to Reason. Did I say the name? Not sure, but there it is. And I just have a thought that I want to offer here to get started. In my last show with Tim Barnett, we talked a little bit about a kind of a worldview that is a materialistic worldview and how it informs how people approach the whole question of science and quote unquote faith. You know, I don't like the word. I'd rather have conviction. So convictions about the nature of the world learned by man through his methods and convictions about the nature of reality learned by God who revealed to us, okay, and our trust in that, which is what we often mean by faith. But I came across a question. I heard it asked in a totally different environment, and I wasn't able to stay around to hear the answer that the person who is being asked might have given. But I have some thoughts about it myself. And the question was, why is believing in the soul rational? Or why is it rational to believe in the soul? Now, I suspect the question was coming from someone who doubted the rationality of believing in the soul and wondered why any smart, rational person like the one who the question was originally raised with would believe in such a thing, because they seem rational and believing in a soul does not seem rational. If you get a question like this, and you know my reflex is always to ask questions that gather more information, because questions like this have ambiguities built into them that do work for the challenger unless they are clarified, and oftentimes when they are clarified, they are nullified. Okay? So why is believing in the soul rational? I might want to ask about the word soul. What do they mean by soul? But really the operative word I'm thinking about right now is the word rational, because this is a word that has two different understandings attached to it, okay? Beliefs that are rational, in one sense, are beliefs that have good reason supporting them. So if you hold a view that is properly justified, which is another way of saying that, if it's well justified, if it has warrant, if it has reasons in support of it, then if you believe the view in light of the reasons, then your view is called a rational view. Now, by the way, your view could still be mistaken, but it's not irrational. It's not like flying in the teeth of reason. It is not against all evidence. It is not a result of trusting in things that are inherently contradictory or something like that. You can hold a false belief and hold it for good reasons, but the reasons just aren't good enough in light of other things to justify it as knowledge. Okay, you with me so far? And that is one way of understanding the word rational. I'll come back to that in a moment. The other way of understanding the word rational is as a word used to describe or to refer to rationalism. Now, rationalism is a kind of worldview. It's part of an Enlightenment worldview that rejected, in many cases, and eventually thoroughly, the existence of immaterial things, believing in ghosts, believing in demons, believing in souls or God, or miracles. Then all of those things are not the kinds of things that can be substantiated by science. They can't be proved by the senses. This is all kind of tied into a early 20th century philosophy called positivism, if you're of a philosophical bent. Of course, early 20th century is after the Enlightenment. These are all waves of thinking that developed over time that rational people do not believe in what amounts to irrational things, but they're only irrational in virtue of the worldview. So believing in miracles, that's not rational. What do you mean it's not rational? It doesn't comport with rationalism, with an anti-supernatural view of the world, with a positivistic, justified by scientific evidence and empirical analysis view of the world. And so if you have a belief that isn't justified in that way, then that is not considered rational. But notice that the rational is not related to reasons, my first definition. It is related to a philosophy of rationalism, my second definition. So back to the question, why is believing in the soul rational? Well, it's not rational if you hold to rationalism, which is tantamount to believing in materialism and physicalism, because if there is a soul, it ain't physical. It ain't material, okay? And therefore, it can't exist. So if you believe in things that don't exist, then you're not being rational. You see that? That's one way of taking it. But notice what's doing the work. The evidence isn't doing the work here. It's the philosophy that's doing the work. And the philosophy substitutes for evidence. The philosophy says that these things can't exist. So if you believe in things that can't exist, now you are believing in the face, in the teeth of the evidence, contrary to the evidence, which evidence here is merely philosophy, and therefore now you're being irrational. You see the shell game that's going on there. But what about belief in the soul as rational in the other sense, that is well supported by reasons? And my response, as somebody who's thought about this, and here I owe virtually everything that I know in this area to J.P. Moreland, for this is one of his specialties, the mind-body problem, the existence of the soul as a substance that animates, is united with and animates the body, which is a separate substance. It's called substance dualism. Now, you don't need to know all those highfalutin philosophical terms. I just use them because I spent a lot of money to learn them, and I want to get them out once in a while. But the concepts are really important because the soul is simply the immaterial self. It is the locus of your identity, the you that you are, so that if your soul were separated from the body, say at death, the you that you are goes with your soul, because you are your, that's where your identity is located, though you are still missing part of you, which is the physical body, which you will be reunited with in the future, according to Christian theology. Okay? I'm just defining terms right now, though, mostly. That's what I mean by the soul. It is what animates, or the locus of, our beliefs and our acts of will and intentions and our sensations. Our feelings are in our soul. They're not in our body. Our soul uses our body to experience physical feelings, but the feelings are in our soul, not in our body. Okay, that's kind of classic mind-body dualism thinking. Okay, so what I've done is presented an alternative way of thinking about what it means to be human. There's two aspects of being human, not just one. And one aspect is not accessible to empirical experimentation or empirical analysis. And the reason is it's not physical. But it doesn't mean it's not available for analysis, because it is not the case that the only thing we have access to are physical things. You and I are in touch with our soul every waking moment of our lives, and we are in touch with our souls some of our sleeping moments, too. They're called dreams. These are all soulish activities. So by thinking about our thinking, we can reflect and determine that the activities of the soul, and therefore the souls themselves, are not physical. Now, how do we know they're not physical? Because they don't have physical qualities. Every physical thing is located somewhere in space. Okay, that's the nature of a physical thing. In fact, every physical thing extends in space. It takes up room. It responds to the laws of physics and chemistry. This is very, very basic stuff. I'm not making any of this up, and I'm not telling you anything new. That's how science works, by the way. If it didn't respond to the laws of physics and chemistry, then science wouldn't be possible, because we wouldn't be able to see how the laws apply to any physical thing in a consistent way so that we could harness that knowledge and make stuff. Okay, so on reflecting about my thoughts, now I'm having a thought about doing this show. This thought is not located in my head. You're not going to crack my head open and find this thought somewhere. My thinking about what's for dinner tonight is not in my head, and it's not in my stomach. I'm feeling something in my stomach, but my stomach, I only use that language because actually it's my stomach that's causing a circumstance physically that's causing my soul to experience hunger. All right? Notice that these things don't have physical locations. Now, pain and sensation, we can locate it that way, but not these other things. Our thoughts aren't located in our heads. Our dreams, our aspirations, moral obligations, they're not physical, and they don't respond to the laws of physics and chemistry. So, look it. If you have something that does not have physical characteristics, but it's real, then it is not physical. It's not that hard, is it? Now, if you want a fancy philosophical phrase, it's Leibniz's law of the indiscernibility of identicals. Just simply means if one thing is identical to the other, then all the qualities are the same. If Greg Kokel is identical to the president of Stand to Reason, well, that's one thing, not two things, and everything that's true about the first is true about the second. But if mental states were really only physical, then everything that's true about a mental state would be true about a physical state and vice versa. They would have physical qualities. Pardon me. But they don't. Our mental states are not physical states. And this is one of the hardest things that philosophers have tried to do is try to reduce the soul to something physical. They can't do it. And soulish activities. And this creates a big problem for them. Now, I don't even have to convince you there is a soul in order for me to say I have good reasons for believing such a thing exists. And if I have good reasons for believing such a thing exists, then my belief is rational. So the answer to the question is, why is believing in the soul rational? Is that because there's good reasons to believe there is an invisible self that animates my body, and it is the center of my ego, my self, the one who you call Greg Kokel, president of Stand to Reason. All right. All right, let's go to a quick break, and then I'll come back to your calls here on STR, Greg Kokel.
As a high school teacher, I always had a red pen close at hand. When I wasn't in front of my students teaching a lesson, you could find me assessing assignments, grading essays, and evaluating exams. The red pen played a crucial role in the educational development of my students. With it, I questioned their assumptions, exposed their errors, and challenged them to think critically. You see, a good teacher doesn't merely tell his students that they're wrong. A good teacher shows his students why they're wrong so they don't make the same mistakes twice. He corrects because he cares. Last year, I was scrolling through social media, and frankly, I was discouraged at all the bad thinking that undergirded much of what I was reading. Then it hit me. What if someone applied the red pen to this flawed thinking? And Red Pen Logic with Mr. B was born. In the last few months, Red Pen Logic has grown in popularity. Through our engaging and shareable educational graphics and videos, we are helping people, especially young people, assess bad thinking by using good thinking, and we have a lot of fun in the process. So here's your homework assignment. Like the Red Pen Logic Facebook page so you don't miss our next graphic. And subscribe at the Red Pen Logic YouTube channel so you don't miss a single video. Class dismissed.
Have you ever wondered how Stand to Reason is able to produce fresh, accessible content each week? We rely on generous donors so that we can provide you with the tools and tactics you need to be an effective ambassador for Christ. If you've benefited from this podcast or any of our donor-provided resources, including our apps, blog posts, articles, and short videos, consider making a financial contribution to Stand to Reason today. Just visit str.org/donate to show your financial support. It has been an honor providing you with a host of free resources for more than 27 years to help you give voice to the Christian worldview. Help us continue by making a financial gift today at str.org/donate.
All right, time to get to calls here. And I want to thank everybody for waiting so long. Let's go to Ontario, Canada. And Scott, welcome to the show. I just was talking to Tim in Ontario. So we're right back to the same location. How you doing?
That's great. I'm doing good. Thanks very much, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is that, I'm leading a small group through the story of reality.
Uh-huh.
And we're coming up to the session on man this week. And I was just going through the sessions, and I saw in the video series you say that that human rebellion is why there's evil in the world. But human rebellion is partially the result of temptation by the devil.
Right.
Who is evil already, right?
Well, I'm straining at words a little bit because of the nature of the question. So I wouldn't say, and this is part of the issue, is whether it's the result of it. There was temptation is a factor in the fall. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think the temptation is the cause. So if it's not the cause, then the fall's not the result of it. What the temptation is an inducement to an individual who makes a decision, which is the cause. Does that make sense?
That does make sense, yeah. And I think would you agree that you'd say that the cause of evil in the world is man's rebellion?
Yeah, and this is where, for the sake of the book, I wasn't slicing things super, super thin. Because, so hold on. No, sorry, I just had to clear my throat. I guess the purpose of a cough button is when you hit it, so you don't have to talk about clearing your throat. So I just kind of wasted the use of the button there. In any event, right? Because it seemed like the first sin in creation came from Satan, from Lucifer. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And so, but now God is given. I mean, sorry, but it seems like the fall of man is the thing that broke the world that we know of, that we inhabit, the earth. It's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. C.S. Lewis picked up on this because he, when he wrote his space trilogy, he called Earth the silent planet. Some things were happening on Mars and in Venus, but Earth was the silent planet because Earth is the fallen planet, okay? So even though, I mean, strictly speaking, the fall influences the whole universe, I think, I'm limiting my discussion in the book to the nature or the impact of the fall on the world. There was a tempter who was the primal sinner, the very first sinner, okay, who came to mess up another world, which was the earth that Adam and Eve were given authority over. And he succeeded in tempting them, and his intentions were evil, his actions were evil, but evil wasn't, in a sense, affecting the earth in the same way that it affected the earth when the stewards of the earth chose to disobey God and obey the tempter instead. And that's the thing that I say broke the world. that it's man's fall that broke the world. It broke his relationship with God. It broke its relationship with other human beings, relationship to the environment, if you will. He broke the whole world, and that's where the problem of evil came from. And so using that kind of generalized language without trying to get into, like, specialized theological discussions about the role of the devil and everything, other than being the tempter who tells the terrible lie. That's what I was trying to do in those chapters.
Okay. Foundational that makes sense. Things. I guess just the conclusion then is that, like, what happened with the angelic rebellion? That didn't break the world. What did that break?
Well, see, you know, it's interesting.
Anything, you know?
Right. We don't know much about that. You know, that angelic rebellion that you're discussing, you know, the first time, as far as I can tell, that the angelic rebellion is mentioned? Book of Revelation. You know, and it talks about the dragon sweeping away one-third of the stars of heaven. That rebellion, and then we have a thing in Ezekiel, you know, with the Prince of Tyre, which seems to capture the rebellion of Satan, but not the fall of all the angelic host. We just don't know about that. We just don't know. What it appears, what I try to do and track in the story of reality is I followed what seems to be the apparent reason for the brokenness of the world, and it isn't the fall of Satan. It's rather the fall of human beings that broke the world that then is rectified by the second Adam, who first rescues fallen humans and then will remake the world in a new heavens and a new earth. So I think I agree with you that Satan has a role. He's the tempter. He's the liar. And there was a fall prior to this, but it wasn't. It does that fall does not enter into the storyline very much. When you read through the story, you hear almost. In fact, most Jews reading the Old Testament don't even believe in the devil. They think that what we read in Genesis 3 is just kind of a myth of some sort. There's not a real devil. He doesn't really show up in robust form along with his minions until the New Testament. And the fall of the angels isn't even mentioned to Revelation. So it's not really so much a part of our story, the redemptive story. It doesn't factor in, and that's why I didn't include it.
Okay, no problem. I was just trying to anticipate perhaps an objection coming up this week,
sure,
or some pushback on that. And I just wanted to say, listen, I called Greg, and this is what he said. So.
And there you go. And
exactly.
Greg said it, I believe it, that settles it. There you go. So let it be written,
right.
So let it be done. Well, you might want to just play this episode, which will be available on Friday. So if there are questions, and there questions do come up about this. But let me underscore this, that I think it's healthy to have a good curiosity about the meaning of the things that are revealed, but there's a whole bunch of things that are made casual reference to because they play a small, maybe a pivotal part in the story, but only at one point, and then we don't get told a whole lot more about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people get in trouble when they try to figure out more, or they go to other sources that will tell them, well, here's the rest of the story kind of thing, and then end up leading them astray. So that's why I major in the majors and the things that have been revealed. I stick with what has been said, and then I don't get too curious about what hasn't been said. And I think that's a safe way to go. Make sense?
Okay. That makes total sense.
Yeah. And by the way, thank you, Scott, for putting together a group and going through the book. I really appreciate that.
Well, it was, they were looking for recommendations for the next thing we should study, and I guess I raised my hand, and so the person who who has the idea has to lead the study, so that's how I ended up. But it's been a lot of fun, and we're really getting, helping sort of see the big picture of everything.
So. Okay, that's good. Well, that was my goal with it. So thanks so much, Scott. Take care.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye. Okay.
Bye-bye. Let's go up to Michigan, and let me get my buttons right here. Laura, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mr. Kokel.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
How are you?
I'm doing good. It's been a lot of fun here for the end of my second hour. Last time I had Tim Barnett on, and he's a ball, so that hour went fast. So, and this one's going pretty fast, too. Good to talk to you.
It was funny because he actually mentioned capturing Christianity, and that's partly where I got my question from.
Okay.
Because I was listening to a podcast with, oh my goodness, I cannot remember the philosopher's name.
What was the name of the podcast?
Capturing Christianity with Cameron Bertuzzi.
Oh, yeah, right, Cameron, right.
And he had a philosopher on, and they were talking about the non-biological, you know, gender issue that we have going on right now.
Right.
And he brought up an argument for, I believe, you know, that someone can just choose their gender and they can be transgender. And I believe in biological sex, which defines your gender, and that's what I
right.
believe. But he mentioned that if there are intersex people that exist, then they get to choose which sex they are, then why wouldn't it be a choice for anyone else?
Well,
so it was hard to formulate that question.
I understand the question. Now, one that is born intersex is someone who is born with an anomaly. That is, something unusual has taken place. And actually, Alan Schliemann knows a lot more about the details of this, especially the medical details. But let's just say, in a case of a intersex, that there is no clear sexuality, there is no clear sex, like male or female. But the physical body has ambiguities about it, so that this isn't like a boy or a girl,
right?
When they're born. Okay. Now, so in a circumstance like that, when you live in a society that is that acknowledges that human beings are binary as creatures when it comes to their sexuality. I'm choosing my words carefully here, because human beings by nature are binary in their sexuality. This is how they reproduce. If they were not sexually binary, then they wouldn't reproduce. That's just a basic observation of the world, okay? And I would say there's a reason for this, and the reason is that God made human beings that way. And so then, speaking as a Christian now, we have revelation that God intended human beings to be this way and to form relationships that were male and female, that were bonded through sex, and that were lifelong relationships. This is all Genesis 1 and 2 stuff. So it's not controversial that this is what Christianity teaches, okay? And it completely comports with the physical reality as we're able to observe it. So let's just call that science. Now, there is a trend, though, that has to do with gender fluidity, and that gender is what you believe about yourself, and maybe sex is what your body says, but more and more it doesn't matter anything about what's on the outside world. It's only the inside world, your mind, that matters, and so you can choose whatever you want. The argument in favor of that that's being offered is this odd circumstance called biological circumstance called intersex. So it strikes me as just unusual, to be honest with you, for somebody to say, we have this biological anomaly that happens to very, very few people in
right.
which they are sexually ambiguous. Their sexuality is ambiguous. And so for the sake of operating in the world, they make a choice, male or female, okay? And therefore, since in some circumstances people are forced to make a choice, then sex is not binary, gender is whatever, and people can make any choice that they want. That to me sounds like a massive leap, okay?
Right.
Do you see the point I'm making?
Yeah, and that's the argument that I was thinking of, is that, you know, God didn't make us to fit, you know, with a female with a female. We were made to fit with male and female. And
correct.
I just wanted to be able to have a tactical way to go against that argument, because I've had people bring that up to me
right.
before. And I know that medically, and what I've learned and picked up is that, you know, even if they are born both sexes, they usually have only one that's working properly, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So they, you know, they have a womb or ovaries that actually work if it's, you know, if they're female. And then vice versa. I won't get too graphic for our listeners, right? I just wanted to see how I could argue that, even though it is a leap, because right now,
right.
I think the world itself and culture is a huge leap for so many things.
Yeah, it is, because what matters now has nothing to do with biology. It has everything
right.
to do with what a person decides on the inside, and this has ramifications in a lot of different areas. I'm writing about it. I just finished a piece, Solid Ground, for April, January, February, March, coming out March 1st, where I'll be talking not so much about intersex, but about an underlying idea that is driving a lot of these issues, okay? But I want to add one other thought here, and that is, when I was younger, there was a medication that was given to women who were pregnant, and I'm not sure even what it was for. It was meant to help them for something. It was called thalidomide. Have you ever heard of that, thalidomide?
No.
Well, it turned out to be a terrible drug that created terribly misshapen children. When they were born with all kinds of very, very bizarre congenital defects, okay? Mm-hmm. So they have children now as a result of this drug, which was then banned, of course, who were growing up with terrible defects, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, would it be appropriate to look at those thalidomide babies and say, see, this is a good argument for us choosing to maybe cut our arms off or our legs off because there were some babies that were born without arms or legs?
Right.
You know, I mean, it's not an exact parallel, because in the unisex child, they have to make a choice of how they're going to live. Which sex they're going to live according to, although I guess nowadays it's not quite so important, because you could live as a non-binary, as they were. They're going to say that we're going to pretend we have no sex at all. We're just a me or a they. Some individuals want to be called they because mm-hmm. they don't want to conform to this other thing. But you see, this is just an effort of individuals trying to think their way or assert themselves out of reality, or maybe feel themselves out of reality. I know there are people, and it's I don't mean to be insensitive in any sense, that feel like they're a woman trapped in a man's body, okay? But that doesn't mean they are.
Right.
That just means that something has gone amiss, and they think that what's gone amiss is their body and not their way of viewing themselves. And that's the old way of looking at it. Yeah, something's gone wrong, but the body's just fine. Look, it's fine. Why mutilate the body to match the mind?
Right.
Maybe the mind is the one that's amiss here, and why should we encourage that? Especially when the result is unbelievably high suicide rates of people who go
right.
through this. And it's not because of the culture. It's because something going on the inside of them, not on the outside. And that should
yeah.
be addressed, and it's not being addressed now, tragically. So,
well, and the other crazy thing to me, too, is this philosopher mentioned that he doesn't believe that souls have a gender either, that they're neither male or female. And I mean, just from what you were talking about before, you know, our souls are our rationale, or how our thoughts are created. And so I can see why, like, certain people would be convinced by arguments like this, or even persuaded in a way. And I really want to make sure that I have the tools to argue against it.
Well, there are lots of ways to go with this. I just offered a few. I do think that souls are gendered, but that's just my that's a view that I have some reasons for, but I can't say this is an absolute fact of nature. Maybe souls are not gendered, and it is the body that is gendered one sex or the other that then influences the soul that is united with that body. But it's clear to me, I mean, this is axiomatic and absolutely clear, but wildly politically incorrect, that women and men are different. Women and men are different. And I think the differences are, my suspicion is it's not just in their body, it's in their souls as well. Because there are soulish qualities of women. Women, women make better mothers than men.
Mm-hmm.
Men make better fathers than women. Sometimes, unfortunately, one or the other has to play both roles, but they can't play both roles well. They can play the role of their nature, and women are characteristically are nurturers. By the way, this is well. There's a lot of ways to go with this, and maybe I shouldn't speak too much at this moment. But I think when characteristically, when women get hurt, I'm sorry. I'm trying to think of the right way to put this. When men get disrespected, they get angry. When women are not shown love properly, it's a different thing, they get hurt, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, this is because I think men and women are different and their souls are different. Women are made by God to give birth and to nurture and to love and protect in a different way that men are to love and protect. And men are made to fight, to kill if necessary, and women can kill if necessary too, but it goes so much more against their nature. And I think it's more damaging to their natures because they are life givers, not life takers. Men have a different role, and both of these roles are critical to the building up of the family. So this, to me, all suggests that there are soulish differences between men and women. But the kinds of reasons that I offer to suggest this are reasons themselves that are observations that are wildly politically incorrect. You know, it's just one other thought. When people want to deny the differences between men and women, and you can see this in movies all the time, and they want to show that there's no difference between men and women, and so women can be in the military and they can do all this kung fu stuff and they could beat up the bad guys and kill it wantonly, boom, 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 all these other people, you know, and that doesn't even bother them, and they could swear like a sailor and all that other stuff. You see this all the time in movies. What are they doing? They are making women sound like men. What they're doing is they're giving women classically male quality. I can be as tough as you. I can run as fast as you. I can kill as many people without thinking about it as you. I can swear like you. So they're not really honoring women, and they're making them, well, it's not just that they're not different. They're making them into men is what it amounts to. So I don't know. I probably said too much. Now people are going to be angry at me, but these are just reflections I have about the culture and movies and stuff like that. But
you can forward the angry emails to me. I'll help you with them.
All right.
I'm kidding.
No, it was a pleasure, Laura, chatting with you, and I hope heard something helpful, okay?
You did. Thank you so much, Mr. Kokel. I appreciate your time.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Greg Kokel here. Let's take a break, and we'll get to our final callers when I'm done. Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love #STRAsk. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. #STRAsk is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, #STRAsk. That's #STRAsk.
Would you like a Stand to Reason speaker to speak at your church or event? Greg, Alan, Tim, and our newest apologist, John Noyes, are available, both in person and online. Just email booking@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers can address a wide array of topics, from bioethics, gender issues, and science, to theology, philosophy, and how to respond to other worldviews, all from a biblical perspective. Whether it's a Sunday sermon, Zoom conference, or YouTube live event, our skilled and engaging speakers can be there, either physically or virtually, with the goal of equipping Christians to effectively influence the culture for Christ. To read their bios and learn more about the topics they cover, visit str.org, then email booking@str.org to schedule Greg, Alan, Tim, or John today.
All right, back at you here at Stand to Reason, Greg Kokel, and in, let's see, somewhere in California, Sheila. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. What's on your mind here? You got a tough question, I can tell.
Yes, I do. I have a friend who is a 15-year-old who was in foster care, and he was abused.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that he prayed to God all the time, and he wondered why God didn't answer his prayer. And this is a boy who was brought up in the church.
Yeah.
And a couple of people, two people actually told him, well, even if God answered your prayers, people still have free will, and that's why it didn't stop. But I don't think that's
Wait, so tell me that again, Sheila, one more time. Even if God didn't answer your prayer, what would I just missed that.
Oh, okay. Even if God did answer his prayer, people have free will. So that the person was doing,
yeah.
So that's how come it didn't stop. So I really seeking a much
well,
better answer, much more truthful
answer. I'm not satisfied with that answer. And the reason is because when we ask God to do things, the request is, in a sense, to violate people's free will. If people were just going to do what they will to do, then praying makes no sense. What does praying do?
Right.
If people are going to do whatever they want, that means God has no capability of interfering with the will. I think there's the issue of freedom and freedom of the will is an important discussion, but I think it doesn't apply in the same way to this discussion. Well, people have free will, so okay, why should I pray
right.
for anything? Why should I pray
right.
for like a job? I'm going to interview. I want to do a good job and get the job. Well, they have free will to reject you. Oh yeah, I know that. That's why I'm praying. I'm praying that they won't exercise their free will, but they will exercise God's will because God it somehow prevails and gets me what I'm asking for. So that's why I think that's the wrong way to answer it. God bless the people. I think that this is one of the most difficult issues to address. So I'm not slighting anyone for offering something substandard because I don't know that I can offer an answer that is going to make a person in a circumstance like that say, oh, okay, I get it. Well, I'm satisfied with that.
Right.
You know, we are all in circumstances in our life. This is a particularly ugly circumstance, what you just described. But I could, you don't have to tell me, Sheila, but I can guarantee in your life, and I know in my life, and even Derek's life, I know it's pretty much perfect, but here he is looking to handling the boards for me. But everybody has to go through bad, terrible things in their lives, and they can't pray them away. So this is a kind of a universal experience that we have, that not that prayer doesn't work or that God doesn't answer prayer, but he doesn't answer every prayer. And he doesn't tell us why he doesn't answer every prayer. And probably the two classic examples I can think of, one we have a little bit more insight on, but the classic really is Job. And yeah. Job is going through all this trouble, right? And his buddies come around and they give him no real comfort. They don't give him good wisdom. It's a lot of chapters in Job, over 40 chapters. So you read all these chapters of bad advice, you know, basically. Right. But, you know, when Job finally gets face to face to God, with God, basically, God doesn't say, okay, here's why I let the bad things happen to you. He doesn't ever answer that question, okay? Mm. He doesn't. I mean, I wish he would. I have questions like that. And I don't mean to, exactly. And the foster care person who went through this terrible experience, I can't say, well, I know why God didn't answer your prayer. I don't. And this is the every Christian has experiences of difficulty and hardship and trouble and unanswered prayer, maybe not as egregious as this one that you just described, okay? The second classical example, by the way, is Jesus, because he basically asked the same thing. My God, why have you forsaken me?
Mm.
Now, I don't think in that particular case, Jesus was kind of in the dark as to what was going on. I think he knew what was going on. I know he knew what was going on.
Right.
And that
right.
he himself said he made a choice to follow a certain path to accomplish a certain goal. But here's what what we can learn from Jesus is that even though Jesus had insight as to what was going on and why he was doing it. The book of Hebrews says, "For the joy set before him endured the cross." For the joy set before him endured the cross. In other words, he knew there was something out there that good that was going to come out of it. Now, he knew the good that was come out of it. We don't. But mm-hmm. even though he knew it, there he is on the cross crying out in anguish to his Father. Because it hurt.
Yeah.
Okay. So we can empathize with Jesus because he empathizes with us. He knows what it's like. He had insight, but he's still agonized. We don't have that insight, but the circumstances are still the same. God has his reasons for doing what he does. And the last thing I want to I mention in a circumstance like this, notice I'm not answering the question, why did God not answer my prayer? Mm-hmm. I don't know why.
Right.
Even the guy who knew why, Jesus on the cross, still agonized. All right?
Yeah.
But another question that I think is worth asking here is, what is the alternative? Now, I don't know if this young lad who was a foster youth, if he was thinking, well, God must not exist because he didn't answer my prayer. I mean, this is the way some people think.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
But now the question is, what's the alternative? And if the alternative is there is no God, then we have other questions we have to answer. And that is, how can the thing that happened to me be evil if there is no God? I might not like it, but how could the person be wrong for doing that to me if there is no God? And see, what this does is it helps us to show when we're facing a question that it's not just about one thing.
Yeah.
If we face a trial or a struggle or a hardship or a challenge or a question that understandably causes us to question the existence of God, we have to keep in mind there is an alternative then. If this is a good argument against God, then there is no God. Now we have to make sense of what we experience, which we think is something wicked, if there is no God. because then it's not wicked. And mm-hmm. so the alternative is no better, because it forces us to deny what something we know to be true, that an act like that is wicked. And right. so that's why going back to, you know, trying to, you know, understand or to accept or to realize that God has reasons we don't know of, and he's not telling us. But the alternative is worse, that there is no God, because the crime against us is still just as bad, except that there's no redemption for it. There's yeah. no silver lining. There's no way to grow out of it.
Right.
You know, I let me just add this. I was on Focus on the Family yesterday, did a broadcast, and Jim Daly, who's the president there, was actually a guy who's abandoned by his mom and his family and everything when he was a kid. He went through terrible experiences as a kid. But those terrible experiences turned out to be the kind of experiences that have formed him into an individual now that can have this massive impact for good behind a microphone at Focus on the Family. And this, now we can look back and see how, you know, the good that came out of it. And that he is the man he is for the good because of the bad that happened. But on the right. front end, we don't get to see that. So anyway, I'm just going to throw that out. I got to run right now, Sheila, because I got another caller I want to get to. And this is a serious matter. I hope that some of the things that I've offered will help you a little bit working through this issue, okay?
Very much so. Very much so. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, you're so welcome. God bless you. Let's go quickly. Jared, thank you for waiting. You got the next 5 minutes, just me and you.
Oh, how are you doing, Greg?
I'm all right, sir.
Oh, good, good. First time caller, so I'm a little nervous.
No, no worries. You sound perfect.
Okay, cool. So I didn't catch all of the show, but some of the things that were talked about did kind of touch on the question that I wanted to ask.
Okay.
Regarding, like, in-house issues and maybe out-house issues. And I remember on a couple of past broadcasts that I've listened to, I think I recall you stating that the topic of biblical inerrancy or the authority of Scripture would not necessarily be a go-to issue that you would, you know, go to if you were discussing
with an atheist. That's right.
Yeah, with an atheist or a secular person. Yeah. So I was wondering, are there any other issues that, you know, that you wouldn't use maybe as the first, I don't know, how to say, like, line of defense if you're having a conversation with an atheist or a secularist?
Right.
Is there any? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. Inerrancy is one of them, because I when I'm talking to an atheist, the key thing is the truth of Christianity and God's yeah. existence, and I can make the case for that unrelated to whether or not the Bible is inerrant. All right. I believe it is, but it's unrelated to this broader argument. Okay. And I don't need an atheist to accept inerrancy in order to believe that Jesus rose from the dead. He was right. the Messiah, the Christ, etc. All right. And in fact, the earliest believers didn't have an inerrant New Testament. It hadn't even been written. It was
right,
the good news of forgiveness through Christ who died and rose again. All right. Mm. Now, other issues like that would be that are in-house, that are really helpful for you and I as Christians to be talking about, but it has nothing, no relationship at all to the non-Christian, or be like the classic discussion between Arminians and Reformed people like Calvinists, you know. That's a discussion that's very vigorous among many Christians, and it's a significant one. But this is the kind of discussion that no outsider will be able to make any sense of whatsoever. To them, it's just like, oh, you guys are bickering about nothing, you know, because they don't understand, since they don't have the Holy Spirit, the significance of it. Remember in First Corinthians, it talks about that he who has the Spirit appraises all things, and he himself is appraised by no man? There's mm-hmm. that verse there, because we have letters written to us, and other people read in our mail, they're not going to get it, right?
Yeah.
So when I talk about the Arminian and a Calvinist kind of discussion there, and the Lutherans are somewhere in the middle there. I'm not sure what to do with them.
Right.
I got my Derek, my Lutheran on the other side of the glass here, giving me the stink eye. You know, so those are all the kind of things we could talk about, but the non-Christians do not have the resources and understanding of the big picture, how the whole thing fits together, respect for the authority of the word, none of these things to make sense of it. So right. Anything that falls into those kinds of categories, you know, baptism, can you be sprinkled to be baptized or must you be immersed? These are all right. These are all inside discussions.
They don't care about that. Denominational differences, they're not really thinking about
right.
that.
Right. And they want to make a big deal about that, you know. You guys don't. I was in a debate with an atheist on the radio, Michael Shermer, a Skeptic magazine publisher, and he made a big deal about all the differences. Oh, you got 40,000 denominations, and you guys can't even agree amongst yourself. And so this
right.
was his...
Well, they'll say that religions are predominantly the same and superficially different. I hear that a lot.
Oh, actually, well, that is exactly the truth is exactly the opposite. They mm-hmm. Religions are superficially the same, but in major areas, I'm sorry, superficially different, like baptism, whatever. I'm just chuckling because somebody says, I don't care if you've been dipped or sprinkled or spit on, you know, it doesn't matter to me kind of thing. So those right. are superficial, but the big things, what God is like and heaven is like and the afterlife, and all, that's where there's big differences between religion. But when it comes to... when it comes to these other kinds of things, you know, I'm just not going to fuss. What yeah. I'm going to talk with the atheist about, oh, by the way, back to Michael Shermer. What I said to Michael Shermer when he raised that objection was, well, if these kind of differences is a good argument against Christianity, then it's a good argument against science, too, because scientists don't agree either on things, you know. So that was the end of that. But I'm almost out of time here. The main point here is that I am only going to discuss with an atheist those things that are relevant to that atheist person's accepting the truth of the gospel and the reality of God. And I'm not going to get into other things that don't matter to that question. I'm
going right.
to major in the majors. All right.
Right. Thank you so much. I appreciate you for taking my call.
You're so welcome, Jared. And that brings me to the end of the show. Thank you for spending this time with me. Randy in Wisconsin, I didn't get to you. I'm sorry about that. Maybe next time around. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Go out and give them heaven. Bye-bye now.